and 6 books of poetry, and has written and spoken often on Judaism and transgender identity. A member of the board of Keshet, the national organization promoting LGBTQ inclusion in the Jewish world, Layden was named to the 2012 Forward 50 list of influential and courageous American Jews. In a recent conversation through letters with Jill Hammer, published on Her Kind, a blog powered by Vita Women in Literary Arts, Joy Layden wrote, "Violence is what happens to us when we try to understand and express ourselves with an inadequate language, a language that has too few verbs and nouns and only the most simplistic syntax, a language that renders much of us mute, inexpressible, unthinkable, unspeakable." Her writing ties into an ongoing theme from this week's seminar, that language is inadequate to meet the complex and ever-evolving selves we are. That just as we cannot do full justice to the divine with our words, we cannot do full justice to ourselves, our identities, our desires, our journeys toward wholeness, with our fractured language. And yet, in the courageous stance of a poet, Joy Layden continues to try, emphasizing that it is our task to acknowledge, as she writes, the wonder and privilege of being, the awe and responsibility of becoming. It is my great honor to welcome Professor Joy Layden to Hebrew College.
I kind of feel like just letting you talk about what I've done. Sounds great. No, that was like the best introduction I've ever gotten. That was. I'm really thrilled to be here because I've spent an odd amount of my life thinking, even before I knew I was thinking about it, but thinking about how trans identity related to Judaism, not in the sense of trying to make space. You know, there are a lot of political issues, making trans people comfortable, adjusting liturgy. There are a lot of very important issues. That was not what I thought about. But what I was thinking about was what my experience as a trans person revealed about Judaism, how the kinds of questions that I had to ask and the kinds of experiences that I had to live through, how is that part of what Judaism meant? How is that unfolding God? You know, in Judaism, the personal is theological. So the way that we live our lives, actually the way that we conceptualize ourselves, the way we even use the pronoun I, is supposed to reveal the presence of God in the world. It's supposed to reveal a relationship with God. And I think that, although if you're like me, you mostly aren't careful enough about that, but I think that in aggregate, I think that it does. I think that that one of the broadest meanings of Torah is this truth about the relationship between human beings and God that's woven out of all of our lives. So I was thinking, you know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about my individual life and what Judaism meant from that perspective. And recently, because there's been such really thrilling movement toward acknowledgement and more inclusion of trans people in the Jewish world, I've started to think, you know, I'm not so interested in it's great to be tolerated. It's way better than the alternative. Acceptance is good too. Inclusion is terrific. But what I really want to do is I want to be like other Jews. I want to give something of my life to Judaism. And I think that transgender perspectives have an awful lot to maybe not add, but reveal. I think that there are things that get lit up in Jewish tradition and in Torah when you read it from a trans perspective. Part of my philosophy is that most things in life have been well stated in the film Casablanca. So that's not part of the Jewish thing, though. But there, somebody asks about a guy in the film, and the answer is, he's like most men, only more so. And this is not a comforting answer. But I think that I would say that being trans is presents most of the same problems of being human that everybody else experiences, only more so, and in this kind of dramatic way. So the questions that I got, which were great questions, they focused on the transition process. But for me, the transition process, which is, it is interesting, but for me, most of the theological action happens not from transition, but from the issue of just being a human being with this particular set of existential issues. So, so I want to kind of start from there and focus on how my experience of being human affected my relation to Judaism and relation to God and relation to Torah, and then hopefully broaden out to some of the larger questions. So when I was little, you know, you're supposed to know what you want to be when you grow up, and I wouldn't say that I wanted to be female when I grew up, because that was a nonsensical thing to say, right? There was nothing in my culture that said you can be born and live male and then you grow up female. I think people can now say that, but I didn't say that to myself. I think that, honestly, I just wanted to be when I grew up. I wanted to reach some point in my life where I felt like I existed. Other people really seemed to exist. It was, yeah, right? Yeah, I'd like to play with you right now, but I don't feel I exist. You know, I mean, it was socially awkward. And in a pretty deep sense, it was true. I didn't feel that I existed because gender is such a fundamental component of the syntax of human identity. So identity is something that, actually, we only have the word identity because human beings, I didn't know this at the time, I thought everybody else was, but I was always just trying to be. But we have the word identity because actually we don't have identities. Identity is an act of imagination. It's something that we have to do. The state of human existence is a state of constant change. Much of it is subliminal. Sometimes it's very dramatic, but you know, we're really, none of us here, I think, would say, I'm exactly the same person that I was when I was 3 years old. And I think every cell of our bodies is, in fact, different. The shape of our brains is different. So in kind of crucial ways, identity is an act of the imagination, and it's specifically an act of the imagination by which we say, we take different versions of ourselves and we put them together into a whole that we say, that's me. And then we retroject that backward and say, this always was me. And if you are lucky, you don't watch yourself doing this very much. Sometimes we do. We have midlife crises. That's a famous moment when we do it. We think we're going to die. There are different moments in our lives where suddenly we see the machinery of our own being and we say, oh my gosh, who am I? What's going on in here? But for the most part, I think most non-trans people, and this is a guess because I haven't interviewed all of you, but you know, most non-trans people have most of the time feel like they are, and some of the time feel aware of the process of becoming. And then you have these moments, and Judaism, of course, stages a moment. Every year we're supposed to have this annual Becoming Fest, where we look back on what we are, and we assess it, and we try to stage changes so that we, the same people, the same souls, become different people in the future. And because that's a really terrifying thing, and it threatens to undo this imaginary act of identity, we call it tshuva. We say, don't worry, you're just returning to who you actually are. You're not becoming a different person, you're getting back to a truer version of yourself. So what I've come to think is that, so I grew up and I felt like I don't have any of that being stuff, and I also didn't feel like I had much in the way of becoming. What I did have was kvetching. And you know, so there was this kind of core Jewish identity that consisted of complaining and being dissatisfied with my lot. And so I always had stuff to talk to God about, because I always had this kind of fetching thing going on. But when I was talking to God, which I did a lot, the presumption was God was and I wasn't. And I think that one of the, again, I haven't done any studies of this, but from what I've read and the people I've talked to, I think it's pretty common for trans children to have very intense experiences of God, not theological experiences necessarily, but just to feel God. I think a lot of children feel God, and I think trans children often feel God with particular intensity, and we often have these active relationships with God until we grow old enough to be taught that we're not allowed to. And I think part of that is because we don't feel like we are very much. So if you think about different spiritual practices and disciplines, most of them are designed to make you aware of the artifice of what you think of as yourself, right? All the things that you call yourself, you need to be aware of and say, yeah, that's not me, because all the insistence on being who we are is what stands between us and God. And the reason for that, obviously, is that very little that's human can really maintain a sense of its own importance in the face of God. If God is here, most of what we are vanishes into insignificance. So if you're growing up as a trans kid and you don't feel attached to your public identity, you don't feel attached to yourself, the grades on the report card are the grades of somebody who isn't you that you're only pretending to be, this is like a huge spiritual advantage, except that it sucks. And, you know, it's, my best friend is always saying, it's like you're trapped in this, you know, photographic negative of enlightenment, which I think is a really good way to put it. So, you know, if one is doing this as a whole person, I think this is great. But if you're doing it because you've never had the chance of being, you don't feel you exist, and you feel, truly deficient as a human being because of this, because without the gender piece, without having that part of the syntax of identity, like I could never finish the sentence that was I am, because I didn't have the gender piece. I didn't know how to do it. So none of that felt good, but in terms of feeling God, it was really good. God was quite palpable to me, and it was funny to me because I would often think to myself as a kid, you know, I'm quite sure that God is here. I have my doubts about me, and I know that that's also backward, you know. So this is another way that I'm different. But because I had this fantasy, because I was coming at this place of thinking I'm defined by not being, everybody else is, they're normal people, and I think all of us, again, tend to have this feeling, whatever we feel is deficient in ourselves, we assume everybody else just has it, and it's a settled kind of matter. It took me a long time to realize, actually, you know, everybody has this proportion of being and becoming. And I did too. There were structures in my life that even though I didn't identify with the person that they created, there were ways in which, yeah, that's right, they still did stabilize me. They gave me a place in the world. And by, you know, contrast to, say, kids living on the street or getting kicked around, you know, there was much more stability that I owned up to. When I started going into transition, I carried this childhood fantasy with me. So, actually, I saw this great show in the 80s in San Francisco, a women's theater group called Leftovers, and it was about weight, wrestling with being overweight. And they were talking about, at the end, each of them was talking about what they imagined would be possible for them if only they could lose weight, and then they did those things. And I thought, yes, this is it. Like, there's all this stuff that I would do. I'd be such a wonderful person if only, you know, I existed. Little details, right. And that's a very lucky position, because I didn't ever have to find out if I would be that wonderful person. So when I started transition, I started it as this child who was always wishing to be, and here I was going to fulfill my lifelong dream of actually getting to be, and like the women we're dramatizing in Leftovers, I thought all kinds of great things were going to happen. For one thing, I thought I wouldn't sweat so much. That was a big deal. I thought I would be neater. My handwriting would be legible. But most of all, I thought that I would be. I thought transition, and I think most people, when they think about transsexuals, that particular kind of transgender experience where you move from one side of the gender binary to the other, most people think of it as you start out here and you go there and then you are there. And that's the way I thought of it too. And it took me a long time. You know, people would say, yeah, you know, transition's kind of something you do your whole life. And I'm thinking, what? What do you mean? No, surely that's not, maybe that's you, right? But that's not going to be me. And then really quite recently I realized, no, this is the transition thing, the sense of actively creating myself, it is going to continue my whole life. And it's part of the difficulty but also the blessing of being trans, of having a transgender identity, is I get to know that I'm not dumb. And that I think trans people in general have a reverse proportion of becoming and being. So there are things in my life that really, they're me, and some of them go all the way back. But the proportion of becoming in my life and the degree of attention that consumes is always, I think, larger than for the normal person. And I used to think that meant that I wasn't done. But now I think it's really kind of the way that I am. So when I think about, and I don't want to I don't want to pretend that my experience is that of every trans person, or maybe even any other trans person, but when I think about what being trans can bring to, if you include trans people in Judaism, I think we're a pain in the butt, basically. I think, you know, Halakha has to be reimagined. Raising money has to be reimagined, because if you have the sisterhood raising money and the brotherhood raising money, well, I don't have to raise money. I guess that's great. So there are a lot of ways, because gender is so pervasive in our social structures, this binary conception of gender, because it's pervasive in our in Jewish thinking, really, to just include us, to include a few of us, because there really are not that many trans people at any given time, requires an awful lot of work. So what does Judaism get out of that? Why not just not do that work and say, yeah, come if you want to, we won't beat you up, but we're not going to bother to reimagine an entire religion just for a couple of people who don't happen to fit in the gender binary. What do we get out of really including you, of doing the things that we do with the awareness of your perspectives? And of course, feminism already did this dance with Judaism. It said, now we want you to imagine Judaism as though the women who are sitting here are actually people. And think about how this stuff sounds to us. And think about what these things mean for us, and think about the blanks in the tradition for us, and think about the things that are inadvertently or maybe deliberately demeaning to us, right? But that's different. You know, if you're half the population, and you have a different kind of a claim to why would we want to do that? But I actually think that the trans perspective, which I'm simplifying into the perspective of people for whom becoming is the dominant experience. And people for whom identity, the fact that identity is an act of the imagination, is something that is very hard for us to forget about for a minute. I think that that has an awful lot to contribute to Judaism. And particularly, you guys are thinking about change in the Jewish tradition. And so we are kind of... you can't really be trans without becoming an expert in change. So I want to suggest a couple of things that that come to light when you look at Judaism from the trans perspective. And then, because the questions that I got were terrific, and I have a feeling there are lots more of them here, I want to make sure that we have a lot of time for dialogue and back and forth. But so one thing that has been an issue for Jews, I would say, since the Enlightenment, and the Holocaust added other problems to it, is that when we think about Judaism, we think about it in terms of an identity. We think about these different versions of Judaism. So when the Enlightenment happens, right, suddenly you have the old version of Judaism, and you have this kind of Jews out in the world being able to define themselves. And that's when you start getting a sense of orthodoxy. That's when it starts becoming really, really important to carry on this fiction that even though halakha evolves, it's never changed. In fact, the contradictory ideas about halakha that you find in the tradition, going back to Perkei Avot with that chain of continuity, that's the identity problem that individuals have projected onto the entire people. We want to know what it means to practice Judaism, right? And in a world where where you're really aware of change and possibility and things changing, for some Jews, that is too much. It's too much to feel like we're doing anything, right? It's too much becoming for us to think about, for us to feel like what we're doing has a spiritual authenticity to it, that we're really connected to who came before us. So in a way, I would say that Napoleon sort of transgendered the entire Jewish people. And I know transgender is not supposed to be a verb, but I think that because the experience of these sort of shocks when your sense of identity becomes overwhelmed by the awareness that you're creating it, because that's a human experience, I think that there are these moments where people become transgendered, even though it's not necessarily about gender reasoning. What the heck are we doing here? So I commute to the Orthodox world because I teach at Stern College, and it's been fascinating for me to see the degree to which this fantasy of identity actually comes into play. So what I found in general is that for my students, whenever they think about Judaism in relation to what is not them, they assert that there's this absolute continuity, right? There's this one version and that it has never changed. But when they're hanging out among themselves, they're fighting about what they should do on a day-to-day moment. And I think that this is actually a pretty common human effect, that the more threatened we are, the more we feel like we're in a hostile world, the more we feel that we're confronting others who are challenging us to stay who we are, the more invested we become in this fantasy of absolute identity, and the less able we are to delight in the reality of creating ourselves. So that has been something that I think from coming to Judaism from a trans perspective, that's something that I sort of can't not see. And I think non-Orthodox versions of Judaism have this same kind of question of what do we do with the fact that the proportion of becoming in our tradition, in our way of doing things, is so much greater. How do we give this sense of stability and identity and authenticity to what we're doing? But I want to actually suggest that if you read the Torah through trans eyes, what you find is, well, I don't think you find any identity. I don't think you find one moment where there is a Jewish identity. I don't think you find one moment where there is one stable version of Judaism. I'm thinking of all the different books. No, it's all about crisis. It's all about change. In fact, for the most part, characters only appear at moments that they're going to completely change. So if you think about poor Yitzchak, we don't care about Yitzchak. Why? Because he doesn't seem to have changed very much. He's the continuity patriarch, so who cares? Right? It's not important to us. Rivka, you know, gets a lot of airtime at these kind of crucial moments, deciding whether she's going to leave her natal family, dealing with the consequences of her pregnancy, defining her, you know, trying to figure out the meaning of her individual suffering, intervening in the rivalry with her sons. Of all of those moments when that are transformational, where people are doing what they're not supposed to do, suddenly the Torah is extremely interested. And I think that that is one of the crucial Judaism is kind of a spiritual mutation, if you compare it to the Bronze Age cultures. And my hunch is, I'm not enough of a Jill Hammer could is, but she's not here. But my hunch is that part of what Judaism was doing in this attempt to say that God is, from the human perspective, God is a relationship. God isn't a specific thing, a specific bundle of qualities. God isn't something that hangs out in your family and passes on from generation to generation. God isn't something, in other words, God is not being. God is just going to be this presence that's going to manifest, I will be what I will be, right? I'm just going to pop up in whatever way. So what is the stability that we have in terms of our encounter with the divine? The stability is relationship. And I don't think that you can shift the nature of the human-divine encounter to relationship without highlighting the individual human capacity for change and reimagining. Because just as God is whatever God feels like being at any given moment in the Torah, partly because I was reading the Torah as trans and partly because I was reading the Torah as a science fiction addict, to me it was quite clear that God didn't have, that there was no, you could never predict what God was going to do from one page to the next. In the Torah, there wasn't any human framework that made sense. And later I would learn that the totalizing of God, the logical assumption that if there's a God, God has to have, there has to be all good, all knowing, all powerful, all this. So that was this result of the, fusion of Greek thought and Torah thought. But if you read the Torah itself, there is no totalizing. There's no abstraction of the qualities of God that logically exist independently of whatever God is being at any given moment. And I don't think that you can have that insight in God. You can plant that at the very core of your tradition unless you have a similar insight about human beings. That we really are whatever we are right now, whatever we are with our whole selves. That the identities that we build, they're very important to us. My hunch is that Yitzchak was not as bored with his life as the Torah seems to have been, But, because, it's not, and Judaism doesn't devalue the day-to-day continuity of life, it sacralizes it. But I think that sacralization of the moment-by-moment practice of life conceals this extremely radical, and I would say trans insight, that we are an act of becoming, and that that's where we meet God. That when we get to that moment of becoming, is where we most directly encounter God. And I think that, I see the High Holidays as a ritual reenactment of that process that contains it, because this is scary. So Judaism doesn't want to send people off into the wilderness and say, starve yourself, and then when you've completely broken down as a human being, come back and tell us what you saw. That isn't the way we do it for the most part. We want to do it in community, but essentially that process of tshuva is an attempt to build in this awareness that we have this kind of radical choice about who we're going to be at any given moment, and that we are in relation to a God who's pretty much exercising the same choice. I think that maybe there's something similar that you could, I think you can imagine a Judaism on that same basis, a Judaism that's not uncomfortable or guilty about the fact that it becomes, that it changes, that doesn't try to rationalize it away, but that says, yeah, actually, this is central to Judaism. All versions of Judaism, and there have been zillions of them over the past 3,000 years, all of them highlight different insights and qualities in the tradition, and this one is ours. And it's maybe different than, say, the Orthodox, what the Orthodox are highlighting, but it is no less authentic. It's no less rooted in the Torah. It's no less rooted in the central insights of Judaism. So that's kind of my hunch about what the inclusion of trans Jews really within the life of the Jewish people has to offer is a reinvigorating, revitalizing of this awareness of the importance of becoming in Jewish spiritual practice and thought. So I think I want to stop theorizing for a moment and kind of, I didn't talk at all about my transition, and I can, you know, the sweating thing didn't work out, but there are other things that did. I'm happy to talk about all of it, but I just wanted to see what would be most of interest to you.
First of all, thank you. That's extraordinary. You need to speak. I just have a couple of reactions and a question for you. One of them, I was struck when you were describing your identity, just the association that came to mind actually was just the idea that only God creates the Yeshmiyayim, creates something from nothing, and your particular identity formation experience seems like actually maybe one of the ways humans actually do that process, like this body does.
Yes.
I'm troubled a little bit by just the. I love what you're offering, that what sort of the trans experience can offer the Jewish community, but I find it kind of troubling to think of a group of people in a utilitarian sort of way. Like, here's what we can do for you.
Of course, it depends on the hourly rate you're offering. I'm not going to revitalize Judaism for free. I'm sorry, go ahead.
My instinct when you ask the question, why should we include trans people, because it's El Melahim.
Yes.
I mean, it's sort of irrelevant if there's anything more to be said after that. These other, what you're highlighting, I think, is extraordinary. But there's something sort of troubling for me about sort of do this because it will be good for you.
I think that's a great comment. And the other way that I thought of doing this talk actually was focusing on B'Tselem. So I want to talk about that also. I think as a practical matter, I mean, institutions, right, many people here are administrators or were involved in making things, so there's always costs and benefits to institutional change. And there is a cost to any institution that just says, we are going to exclude certain groups of others. That is absolutely true. And also, as a practical matter, we always are focusing more on some things than other things, right? So there's a question of priorities. I'm seeing it not so much as, great, now we know we can get out of our trans people, and more like, how do we value this? How do we say that this isn't just an issue of justice. How do we say it's not just an issue of living up to our own standards as human beings, which I think is also crucial? And how do we say we not only, you know, want to make a place for you and give you a place, safe place to be, but actually we want to learn from you. We feel that pieces of Judaism are in you that you can bring to us. How do we value that experience and not simply make room for it and tolerate it? But I think that this, you know, the basic issue of how we treat one another, that is the question of the degree to which we recognize the image of God and the meaning that we give to that. And in my, you know, so most of my life, I was this middle-class Jewish white guy. So I was, as far as I was concerned, the norm. And I didn't feel very challenged. You know, I had this sort of usual liberal assumption that I accepted other kinds of people. But in actual fact, there were very few different kinds of people that I was challenged to accept and say, wow, you're really different, but you're also really human. Let me try to figure out what that means. So one of the consequences of transition is that all of a sudden, you know, I'm queer, I'm a letter in the, you know, string of letters, which keeps getting longer. You know, so now I'm meeting all kinds of different people who strike me as really different, including other transsexuals who are my people. So I'm looking at them, I can sort of identify with them from the inside. It's like, yeah, I have some really good guesses about how you feel. But from the outside, frankly, as somebody who, you know, grew up as in the mid-20th century as this middle-class Jewish guy, you look weird, and so do I. So what I found is that the experience of encountering people that I see as other, that is the moment in which my conception of B'Tselem Elohim, that is challenged, that can grow, that I can see the limits of that. And so I've come to feel, actually, because of not so much my experience of being other, but my experience of saying, well, I'm other, so the people who seem other to me are now us. What does that mean? That has been a real experience of tshuva. I think that question of what the image of God means, and you know, what are we seeing when we see God? That's also something that trans people present a particular raise with particular urgency. So in the Torah, the image of God is directly linked, as I said in that little chapter, it's directly linked with gender. And I think that's not surprising. I think that was an anxiety, that there is this insight in the Torah that God obviously transcends particular crystallizations of the human, and then the anxiety gets even multiplied in the next chapter, where we have to make sure that everybody understands that it's not only gender that is built into God's identity, but also patriarchy, right? But at that moment, first you have the idea that there's this image of God that human beings are created in, then you say, yeah, but that's male and female, whatever that means, and then later you get this political structure that's layered on top of that. And it's because they don't actually go together very well. The ways that we see, and not only see, but the ways we recognize one another as human beings, we make, you know, whenever we relate to one another, it's pretty much on the basis of similarities and differences. If you're dating, then you start reading all this theory about similarities and differences. How do you find the right person? Are they similar ones, or different ones? But how do differences make a relationship better, right? All this kind of stuff. So for us, it's all of that, and it's in fact built into our cognitive processes. Meaning for us grows out of difference. And that creates this anxiety about, so, you know, when do we get to see things? So that B'Tselem Elohim, I think, when you get trans people, you have to say, wait, what is this thing about gender, and how is that related to it? And then I think you pretty quickly get to the idea that God is not human, which I think is a good place to get to, but it's scary, right? Wonderful. We're in relation to this, you know, infinite, overwhelming being that is not human. That's mostly what we know about God. And then we're challenged to introject that and to say, and yeah, the more clearly we perceive this not-humanness of God, the more clearly we perceive actually the inner truth of ourselves. Because that image of God as what is beyond all of the human, that's what's planted within us as human beings and what is obscured by all of the humanizing qualities of culture and identity. So that's another thing to get out of us.
You described yourself as a middle-class white guy, the norm, for a good part of your life. And my question is not about the transgender piece so much as whether or not you have special insight into what it's like to sort of be demoted to second-class citizenship as a female, and it's specifically in the context of your yeshiva.
That's a great question. I just want to note, I was just talking with a group of writers, and there was a guy there who was saying, you know, I feel really disadvantaged because I'm a middle-class white guy, and so I don't have it. Do I have anything to write about? So we know we've made progress. Only if you're other can you really be a great creative writer. You know, one of the problems that feminists have had with trans women, most things are different with trans guys and trans women, and I just want to speak to the trans women side of it. But some of the problems have to do with gender essentialism, which is, hey, we had to fight long and hard in order to get the right to define what it means to be a woman, and we are not having some person born male come in and say, oh, actually, you have to change your definition to include me. So that's the gender essentialist complaint. But there's another complaint, which is for me, transition and getting to live as a woman, that was the primary act of liberation. It just was, because there isn't very much that's worth doing in life if you can't do it as yourself. So to me, it wasn't a privilege to be male, even though there were privileges that went with it. Absolutely. You know, and when I was in early transition, my born female friends would say, now remember, you need to be afraid, right? Part of being a woman, part of being perceived as a woman is you're a target, and you're not used to being a target. You need to learn to walk as a woman. And I had to go through this question. I thought, yeah, you know what? I really don't know how to walk that way. I don't know how to look at the world that way. Partly it was because I was a guy, and partly it was because I didn't feel like I really existed. So I didn't feel afraid. I felt invisible in a way, like I wasn't really there. But either way, I didn't say, ooh, that street is too dark, or who are those footsteps behind me? And that is something that all of the women that I knew, they grew up with and they lived with all the time. It's something that I'm, you know, watching, I'm trying to inculcate in my daughters, because that's the reality. This is a world in which women are the targets of violence. And I realized I spent my whole life living in fear. Not in that kind of fear, not in fear of being physically attacked, but in fear of being kind of primordially repulsive to other people. And I can't do it. Even though I get that that is part of the experience of being a real woman, I can't take that on. So I'm going to keep walking through the world as though it's my world, even though I know that's something that I only get to because I have got to live in it as a guy and not as a woman. And sometimes when I ask this utilitarian question about, you know, what do women get out of including trans women, I think, well, one thing you get from us is you get to see what women look like when they grow up not afraid. The other thing I wanted to add to that, it's kind of related, but it's different, is that I didn't grow up being told that I was inferior because I was female. Nobody knew I was female, so nobody got around to telling me that that meant I was inferior. They also skipped the lesson where if I'm with a guy, I have to make myself small to help the guy feel larger. And, you know, so there are all these kinds of habits that women are socialized into as part of this complementary and unequal gender identity system that I didn't get. I had this female gender identity, but it wasn't a socialized female self. And so I don't experience myself as having become a second-class citizen. For one thing, I have this sense of liberation. I'm getting to be myself, so whatever happens to me is way better than what I had to do when I had to live as a guy. But also, I don't feel that women are inferior. I don't feel that there's anything inferior about me. And when I'm, this happens in academic meetings sometimes. So a lot of academia is dominated by women, but there'll be, you know, these meetings where there's a guy or two, and I can see my female colleagues, brilliant, articulate women, and they're falling silent. Suddenly they're not being articulate, and I'm like, okay, guy, I know you're expecting what you're expecting here. For my gender presentation, boy, are you in for a surprise. Because there's nothing in me that responds to those cues. So again, this is a way in which I'm not a real woman in the sense of this fully socialized woman. So I don't know if that was what you were.
No, very perfect. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes.
I feel like a lot of 20th century literature is replete with characters who are having trouble with the whole being thing. They're alienated, and I wonder if you felt like you had compatriots in the pages of fiction growing up. And the second thing I was going to say is that I had thought of like Ellison's Invisible Man, and if at the end of the book he's sort of been holed up for all of this time and he's about to emerge, and I feel like sort of one of my feelings as a reader is, wow, I wish I knew what it was like after sort of doing this work of realization and recognition of himself, what would happen once he emerged. So I'm wondering if you could talk about moments of emergence and what they felt like.
That is a great question. And for the most part, I didn't feel identification with characters in literature because I didn't really feel human. You know, and character, gender, there are very few characters in literature that aren't defined in terms of gender and all of the social consequences of it. So even though they're a mess from the perspective of real people, from my perspective, they were all just kind of normal people with very small problems. But The Invisible Man was different. that was a mind-blowing book because it really was about somebody who, like me, couldn't complete their sense of identity because they were living in a world which bizarrely insisted on making this, it's not skin, it's not actually skin color, but it's like all people of a certain shade on are classed in one way, right? So this is a character who knows that that is not working, but who is in a society that doesn't enable him to complete his identity in any other way. That's just a blank. And I, when I read that, I was like, wow, this is me. And the thing that was, I think, most profound was his sense that there was nothing in his world that reflected him. That he, because one of the things about being trans, and actually my, when I came out to my older daughter, she got this right away. She got that that meant that I'd never seen myself in the mirror before. So this is one reason that Lacan I don't think much of, because, you know, I didn't see myself in the mirror, and, you know, I'm still a person of sorts. But we are mirrors for one another. So there's the physical mirror. I think there's the more important mirror of the love of our family members and the people who are closest to us. And then when we walk down the street, we are mirrored back in all of these ways that are, you know, fairly low-level and impersonal. And that's where gender and race and all of these other determinants come in. So, but I had felt that I was invisible because of that missing piece of gender. You look at me and you see a guy, and I know that that guy isn't me, and therefore I'm not reflected back at all. And The Invisible Man was the first time that I read a book where I felt like somebody actually got this and was representing that experience.
Thank you so much. In the beginning of your talk, you talked about the notion of constantly becoming and not being able to settle into one defined identity even after making transition. And the first thing besides the trans experience that made me think of was the experience of addiction recovery, of coming, which I really
heard of.
Sure, which I was saying that the experience that Joe was talking about of transitioning but always feeling like in transition, it cued my memory to what I've learned about addiction recovery and the idea of coming out of an addiction but always being in relationship to that addiction and always being in recovery, so that you're always defined by the process of coming out of it. And I'm wondering if that resonates, or because we'll be as pastors and chaplains to people, the wide variety of identity journeys.
That totally resonates. My gender therapist, who helped me through most of the hardest parts of transition, she was a recovering alcoholic, and she referred to that a lot. So, and a lot of the best stuff that anybody told me, the absolute best thing was what other people think of you is none of your business. But if you, I mean, that's, anybody who goes through a divorce should really just repeat that pretty much all the time, that's your mantra. But what that is, and what the recovery process is the way of saying, okay, this stuff is me. This is me on drugs, this is me out of control, this is me, but it's also not me. You know, it's not the person that I want to be, it's not the person that I want to live as. So you get other, like she said, another trans motto is fake it till you make it. And one of the things about trans identity, and I think the identity of recovering, people in recovery, is that you act as the person that you knew you were, you create your sense of identity from the outside in. And again, this is part of the feminist critique of trans female identity is, you know, you're concerned with all this stupid stuff, right? We fought for, you know, hundreds of years to not be concerned with this stupid stuff, and the first thing you want to do to express your female identity is stupid stuff. Why is that? But it's because you've never seen yourself in the mirror, so you want the things that make you the most visible. What are the most visible signs of female identity? Well, they're the stuff the culture has unequivocally labeled as female. What are the things that will enable you to start acting as, living as a woman, even if you don't have a sense of being a woman? I mean, I'm still wrestling with this question of, do I, in the privacy of my own mind, do I get to call myself a woman? And if I do, what does that actually mean to me? Because I'm so different from what I mean when I say woman. When I meet somebody, oh, you're a woman. Right? that means something different than what I would have to say to me. And it does actually mean things to me, and they're not terrible things, but they are different things. So if you, if the, again, if your culture doesn't provide the terms of your identity, then you have to act as if. And that's kind of where I came to in transition. I don't say I was a man and now I am a woman. I say I lived as a man, was a man I didn't feel that I was, and now I live as a woman, and that is the person that I do feel that I am. But I'm not going to fight. The term woman is a term that's central to many people's identity, that is where their experience is radically different than mine. And not only that, it's a contested term because of the violence in the world that's directed toward women. You know, even if you were born and raised as a woman and you have cisgender privilege, whatever, I'm not sure about the whole this terminology, but frankly, you don't grow into being a woman without going through a lot of stuff, without dealing with a lot of violence, without carrying a lot of scars. So I don't want to actually fight over whether I really am a woman or not, because gender and all of our identity categories, they're intersubjective. They're things that we make up together. So if I say, I am a woman, and I insist that you accept that I'm a woman, that says, I insist that you rewrite your understanding of what the word woman means so that it includes people like me who are radically different than most other people, what we would call, or who would call themselves women. So, so that question, you know, that idea of acting as who one is rather than focusing on who am I really? I think that that's crucially raised in recovery processes, because you have these terrible actions and you have better actions, and you're not really sure who's the real you? Where, how do you find that real you, particularly the closer you are to the periods of addiction? But I also think it's a very Jewish idea, right? We'll do and we'll hear, right? First we'll do the stuff, and then we'll take it inside ourselves and make meaning of it. You know, we'll do the mitzvot, and then we'll figure out why we're doing it, right? And it's also occurred to me that, you know, whether or not I'm a woman, that I'm never going to be, in that sense of being, I'm never going to be as good a person as I wish I were, but I could act like the person I wish I were. And if I act like the person I wish I were consistently enough, nobody will be able to tell the difference.
Comment and a question that I'm slightly embarrassed to ask, but I'll ask. The comment is just going back to the utilitarianism that was bothering Danielle. Part of the way I heard it, which felt very profound and powerful to me, is that I think you introduced that section of what you were saying by talking about the need, by talking about the need not only to be tolerated or accepted, but this basic human need to give something, you know, and that feels like a very different angle on that whole question. Anyway, that the question in this reflection on sort of being and becoming and the proportionality of the two. I find myself wondering how do you think about the soul, about Neshama? And somehow that feels like it, for me, sits in an important place in the relationship between being and becoming. So, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not embarrassed. I'll be nice.
I think it's embarrassing.
I feel way more comfortable saying I have a soul than, you know, I am a woman. So I'm we're all souls here. You know, so part of that experience of growing up trans and not identifying with my body was the one word that my culture provided for who I was soul, because we grow up and that's just part of the discussion that I had with Jill, is, you know, she's trying to overcome this soul body or mind body dichotomy, and I'm like, no, that's great.
I need
that definition, because the body thing is not working too well. So I did not ever have any doubts that there was a part of me that, I mean, the real me never felt like it was my body. And I don't think that's actually a very healthy state of being, but theologically it's extremely useful. It wasn't so important to me. So a lot of in a lot of theological thinking, we separate the soul and the body because of the problem of death, right? And it doesn't make sense to us at a basic level that we would ever cease to exist, but our bodies clearly do, and so we imagine souls that don't exist. But the idea of immortality was horrifying to me. I was not enjoying life as not my body. And the idea that would go on forever really sucked. So my conception of a soul wasn't based on that. And I know that this is not a true etymology, but I feel like my sense of who I was very much an active relationship, and it was feeling in relationship to God. It was specifically feeling heard. And I love that that's a kind of a pun. That which is heard is one way to understand neshama. So I did. I felt like I was, whatever I was because I was in this relationship with God. And that was the important part for me. And it remains the important part for me, I think. It's reminding me of a poem. I don't know if you guys are... I wrote this book of my own psalms that are, you know, based on the Kvetchiest Psalms of David. Those were always my favorite. But I wanted to... You know, we're talking sort of abstractly about the being-becoming thing and how that breaks down for trans people and what that looks like. And I've been rather glibly tossing around this syntax of identity thing, but actually these are, as that wonderful introduction was pointing out, these are problems of language in a certain kind of way. And language changes when we shift the proportion of being and becoming. So these are all direct addresses to God. So this is sort of eavesdropping on, you know, what God and I have done alone together, and it's meant to be a sequence. So things get better as the book goes along. But it was written during a pretty unhappy part of transition. This is right in the middle. You're right. I should stop thinking, because when I think, I can't understand what we're doing together. You with your blameless beauty thickening in my window, terrible as an army, called in to guard or pacify a restive population. Me, dying of, well, it's hard to say, but certainly dying, because that's the way you made me. Built-in obsolescence that can't stop complaining, even when you're slipping through my window in search of peace and quiet and a warm, imperfect body to ease the burden of the beauty of things that never die, because that's the way you made them. But you didn't make me not to think, and I can't think without thinking about what we're doing together. You with your undying beauty, and me with the ugliness of thoughts you think I shouldn't, because then it will never make sense. You being here, flooding my ugliness with your beauty, as though beauty were some kind of justification for the death that if only I would stop thinking, would start making sense.
Yes. So earlier in your talk, you said something to the effect of that you felt trans people had an intense relationship with God until as adults they were told that they shouldn't. Or that, and I was wondering if you could kind of talk more on this idea that adults shouldn't have an intense relationship with God and where that comes from and how to challenge that and kind of...
Thank you. That was a pretty sloppy formulation of what I meant, so I'm glad you're giving me a chance to revise it.
Yeah.
What I meant is that most queer people who are socialized into a religion are socialized into versions of the religion that say there's no place for you in this religion. You don't belong in this religion. God doesn't love you, or maybe it's worse than that. On a good day, God doesn't love you, and normally God wants to do horrible things to you for the eternity, kind of thing. And all children, I think, who are, again, socialized into a religious system, are socialized into a system that says, yeah, whatever conversations you've been having with God on the side, actually there are other people who are much more qualified, who actually know what God is, they know how to talk to God, they know what God has said, and this, so what happens is we lose that basic authority that we have as souls, I would say. We start out and we just assume we're kids, just like little kids will go up and talk to, you know, the President of the United States, who cares? It doesn't matter, you know, you're just another very large person. So, you know, kids have the same relationship with God, I think, and then we're taught that we're not allowed to, we're not qualified to, we're not supposed to. So in that sense, I was really lucky that I didn't grow up into a religious family, because I didn't have anybody to do that. I really, Jill Hammer, when I was talking about this with her, said, oh yeah, you're a feral Jew. yes, I am, that's it, yeah. So I had this relationship with God, and I read the Torah, I was into Judaism, but I made this decision, it wasn't even a conscious decision, I made a decision that I was never going to accept any version of Judaism that interfered with my relationship with God, and I wasn't going to accept any version of Judaism that interfered with my sense of who I was either. And this, as a practical matter, meant that I didn't identify myself. I was just starting to write about this. It was a little scary. I felt that I was part of the covenant with God, but I didn't feel that I was part of a covenant with the Jewish people. I was on my own. I was pretty sure the Jewish people wouldn't accept me. And there are a lot of terrible things about that, but the advantage is I didn't have any authority structures to take away that relationship with God. And so that was what I was trying to say, but didn't. Thank you. Yes, and so can we go in that order? You're sitting...
Me first?
You first, and then you. I'm sorry, this is so rude. Closer person and farther person.
I was trying to formulate a question for a little while. I think I realized that what I have to say is the fact that you, a trans person, teaches at Yeshiva University both challenges my idea of what a trans person is and what Yeshiva University is. So my question might be something like, why do you work at Yeshiva University? And what does it say about you and what does it say about Yeshiva University? Mm.
That's a great question. The first part of it is really simple. What it says about me is I'm a desperate academic and I have tenure there. So they will have to take me out with a bulldozer. they could have paid me a large amount of money and I would have gone away. But the more interesting part of it is actually that. So what happens is when I go around talking and like the... you know, I get recognition as though my being at Yeshiva University says something about me that's great. But actually, I think it says something great about them, and it says something great about Orthodox Judaism, that Orthodox Judaism I don't think is willing to officially say about itself. So what happened when I came out to my dean, I was pretty sure that I would never teach there again. I didn't think I would teach anywhere again, but I was quite sure that I wouldn't teach there. I couldn't imagine my students sitting there with me and knowing that, okay, last semester you were a guy, now you're presenting as a woman. Sure, no problem. What page did you say that reading was on? I still don't know how people do this. I've never been on the receiving end of a gender transition, so I've never known somebody as one gender and then watched them move into another, so it still boggles my mind with pretty much everybody. But with my students, it was unimaginable. And when I came out to my dean, I came out by letter that had been vetted by attorneys and all this kind of stuff, and the attorneys and I expected a pretty impersonal response, because that's what institutions do, particularly when litigation may be at stake. Like, if you want to discriminate against somebody, you just turn it over to the lawyers and they send chilly letters back and forth. But that's not what happened. So my dean, Karen Bacon, who I think is one of the heroes of Jewish women's education, she sent me an email. And the email at first didn't have a salutation or a conclusion. So she didn't say dear Joy or dear anybody, it just dived in and she didn't sign herself in any way. But what she said was that she wanted to meet with me and get together, and we exchanged a series of emails about doing that. And the missing pieces, the identity parts of the emails, gradually filled in. And so she wanted to meet, which I thought was amazing, and she wanted to meet, and I said, you know, I'm going to be coming as myself, and she didn't bat an eyelash about that, but she wanted to meet really close to Stern. She wanted to meet at one of the sort of official restaurants you go to if you go to Stern. So she didn't say, yes, there's this deserted part of Long Island. It's on the boardwalk now. I'll be wearing a red carnation. She didn't do that. She said, yeah, let's meet at the restaurant where anybody would go to have a lunch. And so we met at Mendy's. As it happened, there was an Orthodox Jewish trans woman also having lunch at Mendy's at the same time, who I later heard was saying, there's Dean Bacon. What's going on there? So I don't know what she said to the waiters, but when I stepped up to the restaurant, they said, oh, yes, we know you're here to meet Dean Bacon, and they conducted me. So that was a little scary. She shook my hand, and as you know, that's kind of a big deal in terms of Orthodox Derech Eretz. And she told me that I looked beautiful, which... pretty much meant that I would have settled for nothing at that point. And she asked about, she said, first, let's talk about your family. How are they doing? And then she said, second, I just want you to know that you don't have to worry about your family. We're going to keep you on full salary and benefits. We don't want you to have any anxiety about that. And so all of this was ridiculously human. And I think that this is what started to give me a sense that my cartoon of Orthodoxy, which had changed from, dealing with my students. So when I started to work at Stern, my sense was that these were all women who'd been deeply scarred by this horrible patriarchal system, and I was going to be this, breath of liberating fresh air. And in fact, there are wounds that they carry from the patriarchal system, but they're incredible young women, like every semester. And they are young women who, for the most part, more, I think, than many of the kids that I taught elsewhere, have a sense that their own lives are important. So whatever else Orthodoxy was teaching them, it was teaching them that as human beings, their lives mattered. Their choices mattered. What they did on a moment-by-moment basis really mattered. They hadn't been taught so much that what they thought mattered. And unfortunately, they hadn't been taught to write very well. But in terms of that basic sense of being human, that you're a human being and you matter, that they seem to have in abundance. But when Dean Bacon received me in this way, I started to get a sense an unarticulated sense that maybe this Tzelem Elohim is more central to Judaism, and even Orthodox Judaism that I'm aware of, because that's what she was really concerned about, more than the legal stuff. I mean, it took her a while to get to the you can't set foot on campus part of the lunch. The first thing that was important to her was, you're a human being, I respect you as a human being, I see you as a human being. I'm guessing that I'm the first person that she'd ever met on both sides of a gender transition. There was no hint of that. And so although she delivered the bad news, which to me was what I expected, like you'll never be able to teach here again, she said, students will and their families will never accept you. And I said, well, do you think in a few years? She said, I think maybe in a generation or two. Yeah. And I didn't say, no, you're wrong. I felt like, yeah, that confirms my kind of forced fantasies of Orthodoxy. And that is, I think, how Orthodox Judaism talks to itself. So the conscious level of Orthodox Judaism, when, if you talk to the spokespeople of Orthodox Judaism and you say, you, can you accept openly transgender people? They're like, no. And if they're really liberal, they'll say maybe in a generation or two. We feel for them, they're suffering human beings, but no, absolutely not. They're not reading from the Torah, they're not being part of the community. So that was the official line. And she asked me not to talk to anybody about why I wasn't on campus. Most academics, and I know the teachers in this room, you would kill for this you know, we'll put you on full salary and benefits, but you're not allowed to teach or have any contact with students, right? This is, you know, nobody feels sympathy for me in academia when I talk about this. You know, but it was discrimination, and it really felt awful in a certain way. It was the best, nicest form of discrimination probably you can have. But it felt awful to me to know that there was even a tiny part of the world where I wasn't welcome, and that I had to just lose my relationships with students. I don't know what would have happened before the internet, but somehow I started hearing from students who had heard what was going on with me, and I don't know how. Stern is a very tiny, gossip-oriented community. So I'm getting these emails, and none of them had ever heard of a transsexual before. So most of the emails said, I don't really understand what's going on here, but some of them said, I don't understand what's going on here, and I'm really angry. You know, I later found out that some of them were angry because I represented to them a hope of what a husband might be like, and they weren't actually hoping to marry transsexuals, so that was not good, but you know, some of them were like, you know, you were presenting yourself one way and you're actually another way. They were angry about that. But all of them said, we think you've been treated really wrongly. We're ashamed that to be associated with an institution that's treating a human being this way. And we want you to come back and teach. And one of them started out, as you know, I'm very politically conservative. And whenever I saw this student, she's very smart, but I think, wow, you are really politically conservative. I think she went from Stern to one of the really militarized settlements on the West Bank. She's really politically conservative. As you know, I'm really politically conservative, but I think this is wrong, and I'm going to go talk to the dean about it. And my feeling was, poor dean. You know, I knew this girl was going to let her have it, and she did, and she kept going back. Yeah, so what my students were teaching me was that, as far as they were concerned, the core of Judaism wasn't transphobia or homophobia or xenophobia. It wasn't rejecting secular, individualist, blah, blah, blah values. The core of Judaism was human beings have to be treated with respect. That's it. We need to treat you with respect. And if we're going to represent Judaism, we're going to be part of an institution that does that, we are going to demand that you come back. Even though we don't understand who you are, we don't know what this is, you know, maybe it's a sin. One of them said, you know, maybe this is a sin, but that's between you and God. It's not my business. He said, my business as a human being is to respond to people in pain. And I know you wouldn't have done this unless you were in pain. So I felt that opened my eyes not only the living heart of Orthodox Judaism, but to really the living heart of Judaism. I mean, it made me say, I want to be a Jew in the sense that my students are Jews. Yes.
You spoke in the essay that we read for today about the many forms of the silence of God.
Yes.
And sort of raised this point in the essay, but I'm curious, could you talk more about why you see that silence as evidence of God as opposed to evidence of not God? Like usually when I don't see something, I don't take it as evidence that it's there.
Yes.
But
you know, I don't know if you know Noach Desmora's work, but he pointed out to me that in doing that kind of writing, I was sort of articulating a trans theology. Because if you're a trans person, not being is the sign of being. Who I really was the part of me that didn't exist at all. So I kind of grew up with that paradox, right? I knew that I really was female, even though I really wasn't female, right? So the idea of not being being the sign of being was something that was natural to me. I think that was further informed by my father, for reasons that I don't understand, stopped talking to me for periods during my adolescence, and then finally when I was 21, he just stopped. He never told anybody why. And my father's silence wasn't a sign that I didn't have a father. It wouldn't have hurt that much if I didn't have a father. So if you experience something as a silence, then you're experiencing the absence of something that could be there, the absence of something that, right? It's not just a neutral state. It's the deliberate withholding of language or response. So I think those two things enabled me to experience it that way. But there's another quality also. How do I say this? It kind of gets back to the to that sort of pun on soul that meant a lot to me. I had the silence of God that I heard. I've actually heard, you know, not the silence of God also. That's not a socially acceptable thing to say, but the silence of God we're all on board with, so we'll stick with that for right now. But, you know, I felt myself being heard. And I felt myself in relationship. And I felt that it was, you know, there are different kinds of silence. So if you're a Rogerian therapist, silence is the sign of your intense presence with another human being. It's the way you help that human being unfold themselves. And that was the way that I experienced God's silence. But I want to qualify that because there were different ways that I could talk to God where that wasn't the way that I experienced it. So in my experience, God just doesn't take the calls where you say, God, I'd like a parking space. Or, God, I would like to wake up in a female body. That's not a responsive silence. That's just a, you know, your call has been forwarded to the God's voicemail system. You know, you'd like to leave your name and a number and a reasonable, you know, request. God will get back to you. So one of the things that I've learned about the silence of God is that it's, you know, God is called into meaningful relationship with me by what I say to God. And some of the things that I say to God presuppose a God that is not worth God's while to be. You know, the God who is hanging around trying to make me to relieve this or that discomfort of mine, that's not somebody God wants to be. And God isn't being that. And that reflects this teeny little self of mine trying to, you know, get the universe to fit itself into my teeny little needs and selves. God also does not at all seem interested in the big questions of human suffering and justice. And I think that that's because, as I read the Torah, God is not, you know, all good or all anything. You know, suffering and pain and ecstasy and love and comfort, all of these things, they're just part of the spectrum of human existence. It's what it means to be human. If I want to be human, I'm going to be stuck with that. You know, when I was becoming a parent, one of the things, there were many things that were terrifying to me about it, but one of them was, but how am I going to explain to my son that he's been born into a species that commits genocide? And then when we, you know, when he was in preschool and he was sort of celebrating the holidays consciously for the first time and we did Purim, I thought, oh, Judaism's prepared for this. We have the children's holiday about genocide. And then we have Pesach a month later, which is about an actual genocide, you know, killing of children. And this is the way we sort of acculturate our children into being part of a species, being part of a people, which will now and then be the target of genocide, but also being part of a species that commits genocide. And, you know, it's kind of the price of existence. And in my, anybody who can get a different answer out of God is welcome to do that. But in my conversations with God, God simply is not interested in these kinds of human categories of justice that would be that way. And I think I didn't really understand it, why that was such a non-starter, isn't it? Until I read the teaching that if God judged the world in justice, the world would immediately cease to exist, that it's only because of the mixture of the attribute of mercy. And I thought, okay, so, right, so I'm asking this kind of oxymoronic question. I'm saying, I want justice, but I don't want a justice that eliminates the possibility of human existence, or really any existence, right? And that, so I'm asking something that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So I'm not getting any meaningful response. And in a way, I feel like a lot of my best conversations with God, in which God is like that therapist, sort of, are the conversations in which I keep hearing my questions reflected back. I keep hearing the assumptions of my prayers and what I'm saying reflected back to me. And as they're reflected back to me from God's perspective, I start seeing the smallness of my assumptions about myself and about my existence. And when you see the smallness of yourself, you get a little bit bigger each time. And so it has seemed to me that the silence of God is often an invitation to me to grow toward God. I don't have any illusion, by the way, that I'm satisfying your question. But this is really just sort of what it is for me. It's not an attempt at justification. I do think God should be a little more talkative. But I also think I'm not sure in myself how open I am to listening. Right? I think God has a lot of things to say that I would really prefer not to hear. Yes, I know I'm being unreasonable in my anger, but damn it, I'm angry. Shut up. No, I don't want to forgive right now. I don't feel like doing that next fight, right? I mean, there's all kinds of ways in which my being a person is silencing God. I create this little cone in which I'm just, you know, whatever you're saying, God, I'm not picking up the phone because it goes against what I feel like doing at any given moment. And then every now and then I turn around and say, why aren't you talking to me? That's never worked for me in a marriage. And it isn't working too well with God either. Yes?
I was really struck by what you said earlier about how trans women can show cis women what a woman looks like when she grew up without fear. Mm. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe elaborate a little more on that and maybe how that might be able to illuminate the experience of all women, how it might be able to maybe help us to figure out ways to maybe enable all women to live in that way, if that's possible.
It's probably not possible for me. I mean, I just want to disavow the idea that I'm about to illuminate all women here.
But
yes.
You meant that to be a helpful thing for all women.
So one of the things that if you go online, if you say, I want to be a transsexual, how do I do that? And actually, anybody who's interested in gender studies should do that exercise. Because see what the how-to manuals say. This is gender from the nuts and bolts perspective. So they tell you, if you are transitioning to living as a man, you need to take up way more space. Stop with the leg crossing. Don't make sure that your arms are on your lap. In fact, you want to make sure your arms are on the seats of the people next to you.
We lean in.
Yeah, exactly. And it's hard, right? And if you're transitioning in the other direction, they say, okay, you've been living as a guy, time to get more aware of your body and take up less space. Hold yourself in. Be aware of your limitations. Be aware of other people's points of view. I know. And trust me, it's not easy after 45 years. But I had an interchange with a trans guy over email who said, and the trans guy said two things that blew my mind. First thing he said was, I know that I've forgotten to take my hormone shot. And I thought, you've forgotten to take your hormone shot? That was mind-blowing. It's like, wow, how do you get to that place of transition where you're so comfortable in who you are that you forget to maintain it medically? But the sentence went on. I know that because I start to lose my sense of myself as sort of a unitary crystalline person. When I walk into a room, I'm concerned with how everyone else is feeling. Everything that he said was like, yes, that's why I transitioned, to have those experiences, right? So I think that there is something about this gender orientation that masculine identity tends to be more unitary and self-defined, and female identity tends to be more distributed and relational. And And I wanted relational. I mean, it just felt horrible to me. It felt like being isolated and shrunken and shriveled and numb to be cut off from people. And I really wanted that sense. Mm-hmm. But part of what goes along with a relational identity, and you don't have to have lots of estrogen in yourself to have a relational identity. There are guys who can do this. You know, people, these are just human possibilities, but gender sort of organizes them into dominant tendencies. So if if you're a raised female, these are the things that are encouraged in you, that you're rewarded for them, they're what people expect of you. But part of what happens is you grow up thinking about how you look to other people and thinking about what other people think. And that is a primordially scary thing, right? What other people think of you as none of your business is not something that girls are socialized to think about. You know, you should always be worried about what other people think about you. How people, you know, what people think of how you look. Will people think you're rude? You know, did you come on too strong there? You know, all of these kinds of things. These are constant sources of anxiety that come with wondering how whatever you are is playing to everybody around you. Then, of course, you hit adolescence and you get to realize that you are the intense focus of this really weird kind of stare from guys. Right? So whenever you are in public, and there's a trans woman equivalent of this, if you are one of the many trans women who is physically always going to be marked as trans, whenever you step out of your house, you get your stared at, you're subject to violence and harassment and everything. But that is also the case for many women, particularly at certain points. I have a friend who, as I was, I just started living as myself, she said, you know, I'm so glad that I'm finally at the age where guys have stopped paying attention to me. And, you know, I don't feel stared at. I feel invisible. I'm a middle-aged woman. Nobody's looking at me. This is really, really great. So there's this period of intense and really disturbingly impersonal stares, because these are stares that are like at you, but they're not reflecting anything of you back. They're just gazes of desire. And I know that gaze of desire because actually testosterone does stimulate this. It stimulates this kind of impersonal, directed, very visually stimulated desire. And there's research to back this up. Testosterone stimulates visual, you know, you become more receptive to visual stimuli, and it's a more important part of sex. And, you know, so I felt all this stuff, and it has nothing to do with the person that you're staring at. But that's really weird, to be stared at really intensely in a way that has nothing to do with you. Particularly if you've grown up as somebody who's concerned with how you look to other people and what other people think about you, this must be dizzyingly confusing. So that's a mirror in which you're also not being reflected, but some weird sexual cartoon is staring back at you. All of those, I think, are forms of violence that are kind of standard for developing a female identity in our culture, and they're not things that I ever experienced. I just didn't grow up with them. And I do, so when I was transitioning, of course, that is all about how do people see me? And my life really did depend on it, right? If I was presenting myself as a woman, but I wasn't presenting myself convincingly as a woman, then I knew I was a target for violence. And, you know, I experienced nearly as much of that as other trans women have, but I've experienced that. So I had to be aware also from kind of a fear perspective of how I was presenting. But from my perspective, if I could just get the woman thing down, I was home free. Presenting as a passable woman was a place of safety, not a place of vulnerability for me. And I think that ultimately, it would be great if pretty much every woman had that sense that your female identity is your place of greatest strength and greatest safety. That's where your best self happens. That's where you really take up the place in the world that you were created to take up and do the work that you were created to do. And that is what you see reflected back from you. And like other messianic visions, I have no idea how to get from here to there, but I think that for me, that is more what it's like, and I think it is a glimpse of So I get to enjoy female identity, and I get to enjoy femininity, which I know is also, like, you know, that's highly stigmatized. There's a great book called Whipping Girl by Julia Serrano that analyzes hatred of trans women, and it says there's a form of it, which is really, it's just misogyny in the sense of hatred of the feminine. And you find this in women as well as men. I mean, it's just our culture hates the feminine, and you see it even in lesbian culture, right? If you're masculine, if you're butch. I mean, I remember having this despair where I thought, you know, since I don't feel like, since I'm homosocial, I may as well see if I, you know, if women are, you know, that's who I desire. And so I'm starting to read these computer ads, and everybody wants some flavor of butch, right? Some of them say, you know, I'm a lipstick lesbian, and I'm like, what does that mean? Let's Google that. But, you know, because they don't give you a manual for this. But it seemed like no matter who was posting the ads, they all wanted a woman who was in some degree, had a masculine language of gender expression. I'm like, I am toast. You know, I should just become a nun. It's too bad Judaism doesn't have nunneries. So, I, you know, you really can find this everywhere. And there's some of the hatred of trans women that has been directed toward me in print is really coming from women who are just disgusted by the idea of anybody enjoying femininity. Like, only a stupid man. Like, not only a man, like, only a man would come up with the idea that femininity is something you would enjoy at all, but it's a particularly stupid man who would actually perform femininity and still think that it was enjoyable. So this is actually another thing that I feel like, from my perspective, femininity is a language of self-realization. Again, I didn't grow up with it being stigmatized, so it's not a language of oppression for me. It's not connected to this kind of oppression. It's a language of self-realization, and actually it's just like any other language. It's like Croatian. You know, there are certain things you can say in Croatian that are probably, you can say them better than you can in English. But ultimately, it's a language in which human beings get to be human. But because our culture directs so much misogyny toward femininity, it seems like it has this stigma of inferiority and abasement built into it. But that isn't the way that trans women, or at least my trans feminine expression, it isn't that. And so that would be another kind of answer. Like, yeah, you can be into femininity, and you can just embrace it as a language of self-expression rather than, I am plugging myself into the bargain basement part of the patriarchal system of gender oppression.
I wish so much that we could sit here for the rest of the day and the rest of the week. Leo Lampaé, brilliant and generous guest, Joy Layden, but let's give her a round of applause. Instead of going into our small groups, the previously assigned small groups, which is a really useful and important space that we'll get to return to tomorrow as a way to close out the week, what we're going to do is instead based on a model called open space, which some of you may or may not be familiar with. What open space looks like is that we get to talk about the things that we can't wait a moment longer to talk about. We made this shift out of an understanding that a lot of really exciting questions and needs for conversation have come up over the course of the week. And we want to give everyone a chance to propose a conversation topic that they are burning to discuss. The conversation topics could be anything from, I can't wait a moment longer to talk about how feminism and egalitarianism shifts what the home looks like, and who's making Shabbos dinner when everyone can go to shul, as Shosh so brilliantly brought up at the beginning of the year. So that could be, you know, domesticity and gender roles could be one conversation topic. One conversation topic could be, I have no idea what the role of a cisgendered male ally looks like, or I know exactly what I think that should look like. I want to talk about that. Another conversation topic could be, I need to talk about what trans and queer issues look like at Hebrew College or in the Jewish professional world at large. If you have one of these ideas, sometime during lunch, so before 2 o'clock, I would love you to write your topic on this piece, one of these, you know, rip-off post-it notes that Lisa Stella is so wonderfully holding up. When we come back here at 2 o'clock, these pieces of paper, these conversation topics, are going to be around the room in the Beit Midrash. Go to the piece of paper. If you wrote one down, go to that one. Ideally, no.
Not required.
Not required. Go to the one you're most excited to talk about. Any paper that gets less than 3 or 4 people, even though it's a really important topic, we're going to table it for future discussion so that we get a critical mass in all the groups. We're going to be in those breakout open space conversation groups. We're going to assign spaces to on the piece of paper during lunch. So you'll go with your newly formed group, discuss until from 2:15 to 3:25, and then we'll come back together at 3:25, and we're going to ask each of the groups to bring questions back to the whole group. Those can be questions for yourselves, questions for Hebrew College, questions for Jewish communities, or questions for the whole world. But questions that have emerged out of the discussion you're having, and we're going to have a chance to share back as a whole group and hear those questions.
My understanding of open space technology is, if we're using that, is that there's a lot of 2 feet where you can walk from group to group if you're not getting what you need to be getting or you're just done.
Mm-hmm.
Or is that part of this, what we're calling open space here? That feels like a really important piece of what open space
mm-hmm.
is. If we're calling it open space,
yeah.
That's kind of what. So the law of 2 feet, is at play?
I think it's at play. I mean, I think it's at play and to sort of respect the fact that we don't have as much time as the full model of open space usually has.
Yeah.
So maybe make no more than, I would say, one switch in that time, but definitely go with your feet.
Could I also add to that the law of 2 feet, but that doesn't include your 2 feet sort of just leaving.
Yeah.
Going to a different conversation.
We're back here at 2 o'clock, though, to begin the dividing into groups. Thank you all so much.
Not so far from some of
them.
I just wanted to say how beautiful you sound.